Unknown to Pitt, his days of lonely bachelorhood would be temporarily interrupted. He returned to his hangar and observed that wily old Sandecker had sent a security team to patrol the area at the deserted end of the airport. He didn't question the Admiral's concern for his safety. But the music coming out of his stereo was on an easy listening station instead of his preferred modern jazz. Then he smelled the aroma of coffee. He peered into the kitchen and found Morse stirring the contents of an array of pots on the stove. "Who invited you? Who said you could invade my personal domain as if you owned it? Who let you in through the security systems?" All these questions ripened in his mind. But mild-mannered marine engineer that he was, Pitt simply said, "Hello, what's for dinner?"
"Beef stroganoff,"
answered Sally, turning and smiling sweetly. "Do you like it?"
"One of my favorites."
She could tell by the adrift expression on his face that he hadn't expected her.
"Congresswoman Smith thought I'd be safer staying here, especially since Admiral Sandecker has placed a security ring around your hangar."
His bedroom looked as if a bomb had gone off. Shoes and various items of female apparel littered the polished wooden plank floor. The bathroom door was ajar, so he eased it open with his toe. Kelly was standing in front of a half-steamed mirror, wearing a towel around her body and a smaller one wrapped around her head. She was putting on eye makeup. She saw Pitt's blank stare in the mirror and smiled engagingly.
"Welcome home. I hope Sally and I haven't upset your routine."
"It was suggested you stay here, too?" he asked.
"Lauren thought it safer than her place, and the government safe houses couldn't be trusted because of Zale's infiltration into the Justice Department."
"Don't mind me," Pitt said wryly. "I'll pack some clothes and shower downstairs in the guest quarters." Sally had stepped from the kitchen.
"I fear we have inconvenienced you."
"I'll survive," Pitt said, as he began throwing some things in an overnight bag. "You ladies make yourselves at home." Pitt set up house in the Manhattan Limited Pullman Railroad car that sat on rails along one wall of the hangar. He used it as a guest quarters when visitors and friends stayed with him. Giordino often borrowed it for the night when he wanted to impress one of his lady friends. He had stepped from the shower and was shaving when the extension phone in the Pullman rang.
"Dirk!"
St. Julian Perlmutter's voice boomed in his ear.
"I'm in Amiens. I spent the day talking to Verne scholars. Tomorrow I have an appointment with Dr. Paul Heroux."
"Discover any new revelations about Captain Nemo and the Nautilus?"
"Nothing beyond what Verne wrote in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and its sequel, The Mysterious Island."
"From what I gathered from Dr. Egan's research," Pitt said, "he seemed fascinated by how the author created Nemo and his submarine. I think Egan thought Verne built the story around a real person."
"Chapter 16 of The Mysterious Island," Perlmutter recited. "Nemo was born the son of a Raja in India. Verne described him as growing up handsome, extremely wealthy, and full of hatred for the British who conquered his country. On a remote, uninhabited island in the Pacific, he used his wealth to build a shipyard where he created the Nautilus. Nemo harnessed electricity long before Tesla and Edison built their generators. The engines in the submarine powered the boat indefinitely without the need of refueling or regeneration."
"Makes me wonder if Verne didn't envision Dr. Egan's magneto-hydrodynamic engines."
"After completing his undersea vessel," continued Perlmutter, "he brought on a loyal crew and vanished under the sea. Then in 1867 he took on three castaways who had fallen off an American Navy frigate he had attacked. They recorded his secret existence and voyaged around the world with him underwater. The castaways escaped when the Nautilus sailed into the maelstrom and Nemo disappeared. Alone with his beloved submarine, he spent his final years in a cavern beneath a volcano on Lincoln Island. After aiding castaways on the island against pirates and helping them to sail home, he died of natural causes. The volcano then erupted, and Lincoln Island sank beneath the sea, burying Captain Nemo and his extraordinary Nautilus in the depths, where they are now enshrined in fictional history."
"But was it fiction?"
Pitt mused, or based on nonfiction. In the Cerberus offices in Washington, Curtis Merlin Zale was studying a geologist's seismic reports on an oil and gas field in Idaho. He did not look up as an electrician entered carrying a long box containing fluorescent light tubes. Instead of installing the light tubes, the man boldly sat down in a chair in front of the desk. Only then did Zale look up into the dark, sinister eyes of Omo Kanai.
"Was your distrust validated?" asked Kanai.
Zale smiled smugly.
"The unsuspecting fish took the bait.
May I ask who?"
"Sally Morse of Yukon Oil.
A loose cannon in the capital could be dangerous." Zale shook his head.
"She has no documentation, only her word. Nothing can be proved. Little does she suspect that she did us a great service by turning renegade and defecting." "And where will you be during the Holocaust tomorrow?" Kanai asked. A sharp grin curled Zale's lips. "I will be testifying before Congresswoman Smith."